Well, hey there, Vinyl Maniacs. Welcome back to another episode of The Vinyl Guide. In today's show, we are going to speak about an extremely obscure John Lennon record that is highly collectible, as there were less than 1,500 units sold altogether. And we'll also pay a quick visit to Porto Sound Records in Orange County, a cool record shop that has a great selection and is open late for all you night owls. And this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide is sponsored by GrooveWasher.com. GrooveWasher is the best manual record cleaning system on the market. Don't spend hundreds or even thousands of dollars on a record cleaner. Buy a starter kit from GrooveWasher.com today for as low as $55 shipped within the USA. And we are also sponsored by AsTheRecordTurns.com. As The Record Turns is a great record shop in Hollywood, but services the world with original pressings, no reissues. Now, whether you're looking for The Cars, Concrete Blonde, Coltrane, The Cure, or Cab Calloway, Kevin has you covered. Call now, U.S. area code 323-251-4895, and he will hook you up. And with that cacophonous calamity of commands, let's start today's show.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Ah, well, thank you for that wonderful introduction there, John Boy. This is Nate, here with another episode of The Vinyl Guide, the weekly podcast where we get together and we talk about record collecting and vinyl stuff, and really just for people who spend a lot of time around their turntables. This is your support group. You've showed up at the right place. Thank you very much. Take a seat. There's donuts and free coffee over there. And it's okay. This is a safe place. It's okay. We could talk about your obsession. We understand. Lots of stuff to talk about today. I'm going to be spending some time on the Beatles, and more specifically John Lennon. Now, if you are a Beatles or John Lennon collector, you probably know quite a bit about the band. I'm going to be talking about a very obscure release today. It was from the John Lennon solo period, it was a record called Roots. John Lennon sings the great rock and roll hits. So if you haven't heard of this record, that's fine. We're going to tell the whole story about it today. It really was a precursor to the John Lennon rock and roll album, but there are a lot of moving parts and a lot of interesting characters involved. And it was also recorded at a very tough period of John Lennon's life. His personal life was falling apart. His career needed a bit of a jump start. And in general, this was probably the low point of John Lennon's career, possibly even his life. So today we're going to be talking about that period and this specific release that only had about 1,500 copies sold. So you're going to want to know how to identify these copies when you see them in the wild. There's lots of counterfeits, lots of bootlegs of this particular release. We'll go through the story of the record as well as how to determine an original pressing from one of the many counterfeits out there. So also in today's episode, we are going to pay a visit to Porto Sound Records. Now, Porto Sound Records is a record shop in Costa Mesa. That's Orange County, California. And it's a very interesting shop. I've gone there for years. I really enjoy this record store. And what made me think about it to speak with them this week was that a friend of mine had recently gone to Los Angeles, and it was a very quick trip. They took their kids, and they went to Disneyland, and they didn't spend a whole lot of time record shopping. And the reason he mentioned that he didn't get a chance is because they were so busy during the day, and the record shops closed at night. And then I probably shouldn't have said this, but I did anyway. I told him, you know what? There's a record shop that's right near Disneyland that is open until, I think, 11 o'clock at night. So you could have gone, to which point I completely crushed them. So I got to learn to stop doing that. But anyway, Porto Sound Records is located very close to Disneyland. And several times I've spent the day at Disneyland with the kids, took them back to the hotel, got them prepped and ready for bed, got them sleeping. The wife's watching them. I hop in the car. I drive down to Costa Mesa and say hi to the folks over at Porto Sound and do a bit of crate digging. So anyway, we are going to spend a bit of time talking with Porto Sound Records in today's episode. And I also want to take a moment to thank everyone who sent in all those positive notes and emails and whatnot regarding our announcement last week. As you may remember, we shared that the Vinyl Guide podcast is now going to be distributed through the Vinyl District. They are just a great bunch of guys, and they've got a great website and a great mobile app. If you haven't checked it out, go back to last week's episode. It'll tell you the whole deal, all the details of it. And if you're not familiar with the Vinyl District itself, go to thevinyldistrict.com, check it out. I'm sure you will find plenty of information to keep you busy and happy and all that good stuff. So someone wrote me a note saying that last week's episode was the longest episode yet, 1 hour and 24 minutes. Actually, I have to correct that. The longest episode was our Dead Kennedys episode, where we talked about fresh fruit for rotting vegetables and did an interview with Klaus Fluoride. That was about an hour and 40 minutes. It was quite long, but you know, that's kind of the beauty of the whole podcast medium. You know, if we want to go a little bit long, we can, and you guys can tune in, tune out, fast forward, do what you need to do, get to the interesting stuff, or you could just listen to the whole thing all the way through. So it's really up to you. Anyway, look, when I first started this podcast, my goal was to do about 20 to 30 minutes a week. I'm really overreaching that right now, but there's a lot of content to get through. And look, I just keep having ideas, man. Every week, I get two or three different ideas. My list is growing. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to a lot of the stuff that we're doing over the next several months. So please, if you haven't already, subscribe to the Vinyl Guide podcast. You could do that through iTunes or Stitcher, or there's RSS feeds off the website. Just go to www.thevinylguide.com. There's plenty of options there. If you need help with podcasts and all the details, just click that link, help with podcasts, and it'll give you all the details. But make sure you subscribe, because there's some really cool stuff coming up, and I don't want you guys to miss a bit of it. So let's get into it. I'm going to play a commercial right now for a product I absolutely love and wholeheartedly endorse, GrooveWasher.com.
GrooveWasher.com. GrooveWasher.com.
All right, let's face it. Life is hectic. People coming and going in and out of the house, the wife, kids, pets, they all bring dust and debris into the house. So when it's time to play your records, dust and hair and dirt will get onto the record surface. Guaranteed, you cannot avoid getting that sort of stuff on your records, no matter how carefully you put them away. You need a strategy to keep your records clean. And personally, I use the Groove Washer record cleaning system, and it works great. Groove Washer is a manual record cleaning system that uses a special fluid and brush designed specifically for cleaning records. The Groove Washer's special G2 fluid loosens up the dirt that gets trapped deep within the grooves, and the Groove Washer brush lifts it all away quickly and easily. It really couldn't be more simple and effective. The Groove Washer cleaning system start at $55 shipped within the U.S. by simply going to groovewasher.com today and ordering yours. I mean, really, why spend $1,000 on a record cleaning machine? Unless you own a store and are cleaning 50 records a day, it's kind of overkill. Get a Groove Washer record cleaning system today for $55 shipped, and you'll be all set. Your vinyl investment will be protected, and your audio experience will be maximized. And in the end, isn't that what's important? Go to groovewasher.com now and order yours today. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA. Oh man, oh man, AsTheRecordTurns.com is one of my favorite record shops in Los Angeles. They're located in Hollywood, and whenever I'm in Southern California, I always visit As The Record Turns, flip through the racks, and I always find a few gems to take home with me. Kevin, the owner of AsTheRecordTurns.com, has some of the most highly curated, highly sought-after original pressings in America. I mean, he's the guy that the A-list celebrities and musicians call up whenever they need a record. They use his service in finding these original pressings of vinyl. And now you can too. Give him a call, US area code 323-251-4895. Tell him the Vinyl Guide sent you, and Kevin will not only get you what you need, he'll also throw in a free record with every purchase. So what are you waiting for? You know that special pressing you've been looking for years? Well, get that today. Call Kevin right now. Where's your pen and paper? Write this down. AsTheRecordTurns.com, U.S. area code 323-251-4895. That's AsTheRecordTurns.com. So much has been written about the Beatles, it's difficult to find topics that most music fans aren't somewhat familiar with. There are books, websites, documentaries, attributes to nearly every activity the Beatles ever did. All their live performances, their recording sessions, their personal lives, the business affairs, their spouses, their associates, their managers. Nobody associated with any decision-making capability around the affairs of the Fab Four got away with anonymity. There are several books that cover even the Beatles' activities day by day, particularly focused on periods when they were active as a band, 1962 to 1969. And there is no shortage of material dissecting every LP, every album, every song, every recording session, every lyric of their work. In fact, when remastering their material, serious discussion came about for what made it to the final masters. It was eventually decided that if the sound was not part of the performance, for example, tape hiss or noise, that could be reduced or eliminated. However, if the sound was part of the performance, for instance, a drop drumstick or a squeak from an unoiled drum stool, well, those sounds were to be kept in. And it's these sort of maddening topics that Beatles collectors globally obsess on and have fantastic circular conversations on the band they love more than any other. However, today we're not going to cover the ground so many thousands have covered much better than I can do here. Today, I'm going to talk about a post-Beatles release, a solo album that never should have been, an absolute blue unicorn amongst Beatle collectors, and one so rare that it has spawned multiple bootlegs that have fooled many people. I'm referring to the authorized slash unauthorized 1975 John Lennon solo LP Roots, John Lennon Sings the Great Rock and Roll Hits, or an LP simply referred to in record collecting circles as John Lennon Roots. Now, to start off with, Roots is an LP that is very much a slap-together job. It looks very different than any other Beatles releases. On first glance, it would appear to be a record put together in the back alleyways of a third world country. The cover is an ugly yellow design with a blurry picture of John Lennon clearly cut out of another photo with his name and album title along the top in bright green and orange text. The back cover is a continuation of the same ugly yellow background color, but with a song list dwarfed by advertisements for other tacky compilations, such as Soul Train Supertracks and 20 Solid Gold Hits, featuring songs by the likes of The Stylistics, The Four Tops, and the group Ecstasy, Passion, and Pain, all available in both LP and 8-track tape. The Roots LP seems like an import from a nation that doesn't adhere to copyright laws. However, the address along the top of the cover is for a New York City address, and the record label is on Adam 8, a mail-order music label that, in the 1970s, along with Ronco and K-Tel and others, helped supply lukewarm music to audiences across the country too lazy to walk into a record shop. The story of the John Lennon Roots LP begins with Ronald Reagan. Former actor and future president Ronald Reagan was the 33rd governor of the state of California from 1967 to 1975. In 1968, he discovered he had an unlikely competitor for his governorship in Timothy Leary, the legendary psychologist, writer, and pioneer in the field of LSD. And when I say pioneer, I mean that very generally. Leary took a lot of acid and influenced the youth of the day to experiment with drugs. He was arrested frequently. At one count, Leary had seen the inside of 29 different jail cells worldwide. Richard Nixon once called him the most dangerous man in America. Quite a statement from a man like Nixon. Timothy Leary announced that he would be a candidate for the upcoming gubernatorial election in which he would oppose Ronald Reagan. It made the news cycles and created hype all across the country. Leary's campaign slogan was, "Come together, join the party." And for a few brief weeks, it caught the attention of the nation. In particular, the hippie factions, including John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and inspired the Beatle to write a campaign song. Unfortunately, Timothy Leary's campaign was cut short when he received a 10-year jail sentence for possessing 2 marijuana roaches. However, the song remained as part of John's arsenal. At the time, the 4 Beatles were fresh off their aborted Twickenham sessions, which were eventually to be cobbled together for the uneven Let It Be album. However, at this time, the band wanted to do one final album, and each member was bringing ideas to the table. John Lennon brought the track he'd written for Timothy Leary's campaign, changed the lyrics to a bit of gobbledygook, but maintained the original song title, Come Together. The song Come Together was recorded and was the first cut and first single of the album Abbey Road, a standout track amongst so many other greats. Unfortunately, the rhythms and some of the gobbledygook lyrics had strong similarities to a track previously recorded by Chuck Berry, a song called You Can't Catch Me. The rhythms and vocal line of the Beatles' Come Together are like a slowed down or swampy version of the Chuck Berry tune. And the line, Here Come Old Flat Top,
yeah, come on, Flat Top, he was moving up with me, then come,
clearly inspired the Beatles' final version. Unfortunately for Lennon and the Beatles, the publishing rights to the Chuck Berry tune was managed by Big Seven Music, which was owned by the notorious, aggressive, and well-connected individual Morris Levy, a man who many suspected of being in the inner circles of the most powerful associates of organized crime. Morris Levy was, to put it lightly, an intimidating and effective character in the music business. At his peak, he owned over 90 companies and employed nearly 1,000 people. The properties in which Morris Levy owned and managed at one time or another were Roulette Records, Buddha Records, Sugar Hill Records, Sutra Records, an 81-store chain of record stores on the East Coast, and even the famous Birdland Jazz Club in New York City. Levy also owned several record pressing and tape duplication plants, which at the time were similar to owning machines that could print money. Records and tapes were ubiquitous and untraceable. And these pressing plants would allow the owners to create product at will without having to manage accounts and royalties for artists. In other words, Morris Levy quite presumably operated on the sketchy side of the law. Levy heard the Beatles track Come Together and immediately began discussions with the attorneys who represented the Fab Four. Levy, as owner of Chuck Berry's catalog through Big Seven Music, demanded an equal share of the royalties for the Beatles song Come Together, which wouldn't have been the first time Chuck Berry's name was attached to a song after its initial release. In 1963, the Beach Boys released Surfin' USA, a song at the time credited solely to Brian Wilson.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody be surfing like California.
However, whose melody was entirely from Chuck Berry's track Sweet Little 16.
They're really rocking in Boston and Pittsburgh, PA. Deep in the heart of Texas and round the Frisco Bay, all over St. Louis and down in New Orleans.
Brian Wilson even boasted in the press that he wrote the lyrics to the song to the melody of Chuck Berry's song. Smoking guns don't get any hotter than that. And then Beach Boys manager Murray Wilson, father of Brian and Carl Wilson, felt pressured to respond. And not being the shrewd negotiator, simply gave the entire rights to the song Surfin' USA to Chuck Berry. From that point forward, all versions of Surfin' USA, the globally renowned song, bear credit only to Chuck Berry, not even acknowledging Brian's lyrical contributions. Just look up any copy of that record pressed since 1966, and you'll see the only songwriter credited is Chuck Berry. So the Beatles, and especially John, were in a bit of a bind. In fact, Paul was cleared early on and wasn't even named personally in the original filings from Morris Levy and Big Seven Music. The song Come Together was clearly John's, and the focus and responsibility to fix it was on him, which, to his credit, he didn't shirk. He did get creative, however, and it was agreed that, rather than alter the credits of The Beatles Come Together and create a big mess, another plan could service the needs of all involved. Levy, through Big Seven Music, held the copyrights to many classic early rock and roll tunes, and John Lennon, at the time feeling somewhat creatively spent, yearned to create a simple album of oldies for fun. It seemed like a perfect fit. Levy would drop the lawsuit, and Lennon would ensure that on his next solo album, at least three songs owned by Big Seven Music would be on it. Sales of ex-Beatles material would naturally be stellar, so everyone would benefit. It seemed like this mess was all going to work itself out. The plan for Lennon to record an oldies record with at least three Big Seven songs started to unravel pretty quickly. At first, Lennon decided to employ Phil Spector as the record producer. Spector, a well-known control freak that possibly suffers from paranoid delusions, stayed true to form and brought serious insanity to the recording sessions. Lennon may have been able to see this coming if he himself weren't starting to become undone. Lennon was embarking on his lost weekend phase, which was an 18-month period of John Lennon's life where he was separated from Yoko Ono, dating his assistant May Pang, crisscrossing the country, drinking heavily, and generally not giving much of a care to his responsibilities. Previous to this period, his last two solo albums, Sometime in New York City and Mind Games, were commercial flops and general embarrassments, where the quote-unquote lesser Beatles, George Harrison and Ringo Starr, were accelerating their careers. George Harrison had released All Things Must Pass and Concert for Bangladesh, two massive hits with multi-record sets, and even Ringo Starr albums were getting decent reviews and sales. Lennon started caving to the pressure. He was blaming Yoko Ono for ruining his career and reacted by taking up with another woman for this period of his life. And to top it all off, Lennon was subject to a targeted federal investigation triggered by his extreme vocal objection to multiple U.S. policies, including the war in Vietnam. For the crime of exercising his freedom of speech, Lennon was being threatened with deportation from the United States. So in order to get away from the drama in New York, the recording sessions were held in Los Angeles, but the surroundings quickly became too tempting. Lennon was hitting the bottle hard and hanging out with other troublemakers like Harry Nilsson. The stories of these two guys getting drunk were legendary and, in fact, downright scary. Lennon and Nilsson would bar hop from one Los Angeles club to another, being belligerent, getting into fights, even getting kicked out of clubs for disrupting live acts. One night, after an extended bout of drinking, the two of them went to A&M Studios and began one-upping each other by screaming as hard as they could into a microphone, which legend tells us as the night Harry Nilsson ruined his voice. Onlookers saw blood on the microphone, indicating that he'd inflicted major damage to the instrument he was so well known for. And while Lennon was carousing the Sunset Strip at all hours of the night, Phil Spector was in charge of the recording sessions for an ex-Beatle. Known for his excess and unpredictability, Spector would start the day drunk and things would just go downhill from there. Spector, also known for his paranoia, would routinely bring a handgun into the recording sessions and wave it around when the moment apparently called for it. In one of these sessions, Spector accidentally discharged a shot, thankfully missing the musicians, but putting a hole in the studio's soundproof ceiling. In another session, Spector accidentally knocked a partially full whiskey bottle across the recording console worth $250,000. And just to ensure things stayed crazy, Spector was also put in charge of the budget for the project. This level of authority led the project cost to be completely overblown. Spector would arrange recording sessions with two or three dozen hired musicians, and Leonard would simply not show up and end up paying everyone a day's union wages without having a single note recorded. And on days when notes were recorded, Spector would wind down the recording day by removing all the master tapes from the studio and taking them home with him, which is a major faux pas and generally regarded as a complete ethical breach. These days, recording studios typically lock up all the master tapes and hold them there until the recording is finally complete. However, in the early 1970s, there weren't any disastrous examples that taught people differently, so nobody thought to stop Spector from taking those tapes home. I mean, what's the worst that can happen when a paranoid, delusional, alcoholic gun nut puts the project master tapes into the boot of his car and drunkenly speeds away? Well, you guessed it. Spector had all the John Lennon session tapes at his house when at one point his delusions became unmanageable and Spector just stopped showing up at the studio. Recording execs, studio heads, even John Lennon himself tried to reach out to Spector, who insisted on speaking to them only over the phone, talking about Watergate tapes and, in general, raising the level of crazy beyond any productive means. And nobody dared go over to Spector's home and confront him, as again, he was well-armed and delusional to a dangerous level. Then, on March 31st, 1974, Phil Spector was in a near-fatal car crash, which altered his life forever. He was thrown through the windshield and sustained major head injuries. It was a gruesome scene, and Spector was nearly declared dead at the scene when a faint pulse was finally detected. Spector was admitted into UCLA Medical Center, where he underwent several hours of surgery, resulting in over 700 stitches around his head and face. It is said that these wounds and scars played a large factor in why Spector wore all the outlandish wigs for decades afterward. And with Phil Spector recuperating from a near-fatal car crash and the assumption that the session tapes weren't coming back anytime soon, John Lennon took stock of his behavior and started writing music again, songs that started to take shape into an LP that would eventually become Walls and Bridges. Tired of the L.A. scene and the Spector-produced sessions with wall-to-wall musicians, Lennon went east to upstate New York to work with a small backing band as he started recording all these new songs. When he was midway through recording, word came that Al Khoury, then head of A&R for Capitol Records, had successfully negotiated with Phil Spector to get the master tapes of the oldie sessions back for Lennon. While Lennon was understandably relieved, he kept his focus on the recording sessions that he had underway. His creative juices were flowing, and he wanted to finish what he started. The Oldies album would simply have to wait, at least until he finished production of Walls and Bridges.
Listen to this television commercial.
Whatever gets you through the night.
Listening to John Lennon's new album, Walls and Bridges.
Thank you, Ringo.
It's a pleasure, John.
When Walls and Bridges was completed and released in September of 1974, Morris Levy was furious. He had an agreement with Lennon to have three Big Seven tunes on his next album, which clearly did not happen. Lennon attempted to explain to Levy the situation with Spector and the car accident and the master tapes, but Levy was not a man who was used to people going back on their word. He demanded Lennon make good, and it was clear to Lennon that he meant it. This breach would put Lennon in more legal problems than ever, particularly at a time when Lennon was trying to release himself from the grips and the legacy of Beatles and Apple Records. Another lawsuit would put no end in sight and delay the freedom that Lennon desperately craved. John Lennon then retreated to New York and began reviewing the tapes of the oldies sessions he'd recorded with Phil Spector, and upon listening, was very disappointed. Here were fragments of several months' work featuring a very drunk John Lennon, who at times didn't take the time to tune his guitar properly, with studio musicians being managed by a drunk, paranoid, gun-toting Phil Spector. The sessions were a complete mess, and Lennon decided that most of these tapes were unusable. As a path forward, John started rehearsing some of the oldies with the four-piece band he'd assembled for the Walls and Bridges sessions. Within a week, the Oldies album, which Lennon originally wanted to do for cathartic reasons, but was now doing for legal obligations, was starting to come into shape. And, eager to show a sign of good faith, Lennon met with Morris Levy and handed him a tape of rough mixes of the Oldies tracks he and the band were working on. It was a way for Lennon to show that he was in the process of making things right, and felt the tape would serve as a way to get Levy's confidence back in the plan. Once Levy had the tape, however, he began to hatch a plan of his own.
Now, Adam 8 presents the incredible John Lennon singing 15 of the great rock and roll hits never before available anywhere. You get 15 great hits in one fabulous record album for just $4.98. Hear John Lennon sing Ain't That a Shame? Slippin' and a Slidin'. Be My Baby. Do You Wanna Dance? You get other fabulous songs like Peggy Sue, Bebopalula, Boney Maroney, Angel Baby, Ya-Ya, Sweet Little 16, Rip It Up, and many more. Yes, John Lennon sings 15 great rock and roll hits, all in one fantastic album for just $4.98 or $5.98 for 8-track tape. Here's how to order.
In January of 1975, the record label, Adam 8, a label owned by Morris Levy and specializing in mail order of compilations of milquetoast simmy hits, began running television ads for an album of oldies as recorded by John Lennon. They called this album Roots, John Lennon Sings the Great Rock and Roll Hits, an album simply now called Roots. Roots was available via mail order for the low, low price of $4.98 and available on record and 8-track tape. These television ads ran for exactly 3 days in January of 1975 before Lennon, Apple, and EMI stepped in with a cease and desist order. Exactly how this record came to be depends on who you believe. Levy claims John Lennon gave him the rough mixes and agreed to let Levy's Adam 8 record label sell and distribute them, even agreeing to make a personal appearance in a TV commercial. But that's a bit of a stretch. John Lennon had been around the record business long enough by now to know that he was contractually obligated to work through Capitol Records and didn't have the authority to make those sort of decisions. However, he could have made an agreement or verbally led Morris Levy on, perhaps because he felt intimidated or just wasn't used to telling people no. Additionally, it's clear the tapes given to Levy were not professionally mixed. In fact, the tape itself was at a speed of 7.5 IPS, or 7.5 inches per second. And while that's perfectly fine quality for general listening, it is not a speed used for a professional master of a recording. Most professional masters of the day were at 30 inches per second, which captures more audio signal, dynamic range, and in general provides a much higher sound quality on the record. The more likely scenario was that Levy just wasn't used to the pace of the record industry. Lennon had provided him a rough mix tape of tracks. However, the process to go from rough idea through rehearsal to final product and eventual royalty payments can take years. So Levy just went forward and forced the hand of Lennon and Capitol Records to release the LP, which, in hindsight, kind of worked. Lennon and the band rushed into the record plant in New York City, cut the tracks that would eventually be on the rock and roll album, and Capitol Rush released it. Now, it's clear that Capitol Records wasn't especially excited about the release of the John Lennon rock and roll album. First off, for what was envisioned to be a quick money-making, John Lennon sings the hits sort of release, it was an incredibly expensive project. Beyond the cost of the New York City record plant sessions were the entire Los Angeles recording sessions, the Phil Spector drunken madness, endless studio musicians, payment to purchase back the stolen master tapes, the payment to A&M Studios to repair their recording console and fix the bullet hole in the studio, and now they were rush releasing a product to compete with a cheap mail order offer run by a reported mobster. And to add insult to injury, Capitol Records decided to make the John Lennon Rock and Roll album a Capitol budget release, which generally sells for a dollar less than typical releases of the day. And all these expenses still don't include the upcoming cost of litigation. Capitol was within their rights to stop any third-party pressing of John Lennon material. So, off to court they went. Atom 8 record label was forced to stop advertising and distributing the Roots LP while its fate was being decided. In early 1976, the courts decided that Morris Levy was to pay nearly $110,000 to EMI for lost revenue related to the sales damage of the John Lennon Rock and Roll album, as well as $42,000 to John Lennon for damages to his reputation by releasing a poor quality product. Additionally, Lennon was forced to pay Morris Levy for the use of his Chuck Berry tune in the song Come Together in the amount of $6,795. As part of the court settlement, no more copies of the Roots LP could be manufactured. John Lennon even commented on the cheapness of the Roots records and the manufacturing, stating that they not only sounded bad, but they took him nearly a month to get it after ordering copies for himself off the TV. So for you record collectors out there, here's what you need to know about the John Lennon Roots LP. Now, according to court paperwork and the cease and desist records, there were only 3,000 units pressed and a reported 1,270 units shipped of the LP. So, with the extreme popularity of the artist and the story around this record, originals are expensive and therefore bootlegs and counterfeits are common. Now, if you find a copy of the Roots record, there are a few telltale signs of original pressings. Number one, look at the cover. Can you see John Lennon's shoulder? If so, that's a good sign. If not, you have a counterfeit. The original issue has a picture with just the start of his shoulders on the cover, and common counterfeits crop this picture slightly to remove the shoulders. Number two, check the legibility of the text on the back cover. If you could read all the text, especially that of the other Atom 8 LPs that are advertised, that is a good sign. Most counterfeits have poor printing quality, and the small text starts to run together. Thing to check number three, the text on the spine of the record. Original copies have the word great on the spine, when the common counterfeits use the word greatest. Number four, the Roots LPs shipped with a printed sleeve advertising other Atom 8 record releases the listeners could purchase, as well as a mail order sheet pre-printed for the for the people who wanted to buy other Atom 8 releases. If you have these inserts, you've done well, as they are exceedingly rare. And thing to check number five, make sure to look in the runout groove for a stamp that says Bell Sound. If your record has this stamp, your version is likely one of the 3,000 original pressings. So all up, if your record meets the criteria just stated, you can expect between $100 and $500 depending on condition. Now, even rarer is the 8-track version of Roots, which, according to court records, only 175 units were shipped. This item is completely missing from view, and I haven't even been able to locate a picture of one, much less get a price. If you or someone you know has a copy of the Roots 8-track tape or even a picture of a copy, please email me, nate@thevinylguide.com, as I'd love to see what one looks like. The John Lennon Rock and Roll album went on to become the second worst-selling John Lennon solo album, just behind Sometime in New York City, the album that caused an 18-month rift in John and Yoko's relationship. However, at the very bottom of the heap would be Roots, an album that only sold 1,445 units if you count both LP and 8-track. It was the absolute nadir of John Lennon's career, perhaps his life, coming at a time when he was losing his sanity, his wife, he was fighting deportation from the United States, his creativity stalled, he struggled with alcohol and God knows what else, and he was being used by people, all while being chased for money by a reported mobster. Plus, the Roots LP is nearly unlistable. The copies of the rough mixes are on cheap vinyl, shoddy packaging, and semi-neon colors surrounding a picture of Lennon taken nearly a decade earlier with advertisements for cheap compilations on the back. It's no wonder that after this experience, Lennon decided to take a few years off, remove himself entirely from the music business indefinitely, and just focus on raising his son. The John Lennon Rock and Roll album was the last record he recorded until the 1980 release of Double Fantasy, an album released just 3 weeks before his fatal shooting. So for the second part of today's show, I'm going to play an interview with Porto Sound in Costa Mesa, California, which is in Orange County. Now, I discovered this shop years ago, and to me, Porto Sound has three very special traits. Number one, they always have great stock, great collectibles, and $2 bins. So they've got kind of something for everyone, each end of the spectrum. The second thing I love about Porto Sound Records, it's open late. So when the kids are sleeping after a long day at Disneyland, I can get out, and a short drive later, I'm flipping through some of them record racks. And the third reason I love Porto Sound Records, it holds a special place in my heart. This was the shop that I got a copy of my favorite LP of all time, John Lee Hooker, Serves You Right to Suffer, on Impulse Records. So a very special memory was made there at Porto Sound Records many years ago. So if you are in Orange County and you want to enjoy the OC's biggest record shop, make sure to check out Porto Sound. And with that, let's go to Porto Sound Records. So continuing the record road trip around Southern California and remaining in Orange County, the town of Costa Mesa. The locals are very quick to say there's a T in there, Costa Mesa. But I'm here at this record store that I've been in several times before, and I wanted to make a quick stop here to say hi. I'm here with Kimberly of Porto Sound Records. How are you, Kimberly?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good. Porto Sound Records is really interesting, I think. As I said, I've been here several times. You've got quite a variety of records here. Is it entirely vinyl in this shop?
For the most part, we do have audio equipment, cassette tapes. The kids are kind of into that these days. A few CDs, but mostly vinyl.
Okay. So, and what's the percentage of used to new vinyl?
That's hard to say. At this point, it's probably about 50-50. We have, almost 30,000 records in here. So mm-hmm. I'd say we're between the 45s and the full LPs, we're probably about 50-50.
Wow. Okay. And there's an impressive selection here, especially on the walls. You've got a lot of collector's items as well. Who is your typical customer here? And what kind of genre do they look for? And I know there could be a lot of different ones, but are there some clear main ones out front?
You know, we really get people all across the board. We're the biggest record store in Orange County, so our biggest competitor is Amoeba in LA. And what we're trying to do is cater to the people that go and enjoy all genres there. So our biggest thing is, you know, we have our jazz collectors. We have a great collection. Hip hop is very popular here. Our funk and soul, people love that. We even have our punk, our metal. Orange County has a huge punk scene. And then we kind of combine all the indie, pop, and rock together. Mm-hmm. And then electronic soundtracks, those things are all pretty popular with the younger crowd. Mm-hmm. But we try to, you know, bring everything in so that anybody that comes in, whether you're 16 or 60, you can find something old, new, in between.
What are some of the more interesting records that you have in stock, collectibles right now?
One of the big ones in Orange County is this Beach Boulevard compilation. It's really hard to find. It's really rare that we actually have two copies at the moment. X is another punk band that very, very popular in Orange County. Their album Los Angeles is really hard to find. It's pretty amazing that we have three copies at the moment. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Blue Note Jazz, the Verve Jazz, a lot of that stuff is tough to come by, especially in good condition. We have a good selection of that right now. And then we also have, you know, finding original Smiths, finding good, clean, original Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, some of those obscure records. It gets a little tough. So it's pretty impressive that we have that type of thing on the wall at the moment.
And where do you get most of your used stuff? Is it stuff that walks in the door? Do you buy collections?
Initially, we did go out and dig, but once the store became established, we've been open 5 years now, about 5 years, people started walking in, and it's really amazing whether it's, you know, my parents passed away, or I found it in a storage unit, or we're moving, my wife has told me, you know, it's time to clear out, whatever the case may be. We have people walking in every single day, and you know, most of the time you're looking at pop vocals and, you know, the 99-cent rack. But sometimes some really amazing gems walk in just because of the area that we're in.
And what are some of those gems that you've seen? Maybe you don't have now, but you were really impressed to see them come in.
You know, we've seen Butcher covers, not necessarily in the best shape. We've seen Pet Sounds come in, original mono presses. A lot of really amazing punk stuff, original press metal, like I said, a lot of that Blue Note jazz. With LA and all the record labels being nearby, we have a lot of people that either worked there or had friends that worked there or friends with the bands. And
a lot of promo copies and that sort of thing.
Definitely, yeah. And that's stuff that we're always really looking for. UK presses, promo copies, white label, even acetates. We get acetates in from time to time. And I mean, it's pretty amazing to see that kind of stuff and just how pristine they are.
Wow. And do you do much online or is it all through the shop?
You know, we do. We eventually want to kind of take our website and build it into a store, but for the time being, eBay's been a really great option. We have probably thousands of items up at the moment, and we ship globally, and you know, we see every kind of collector. We'll put a lot of new stuff up there, you know, things that we get a lot of that we know, you know, someone in Kansas probably doesn't have easy access to. So we put that kind of stuff up. But then we get, like, we just had from the Third Man Vault, somebody just randomly brought in the 45s that come along with the vault packages. And we just put a couple of those up, and they sold within 24 hours. So we get a full range of things, which is nice.
I think one thing that I've always appreciated out of Porto Sound is the hours. You guys are open, is it till midnight?
Fridays and Saturdays, we are open until midnight. The rest of the week is till 11 p.m. Sunday, we cut it back a little bit to 10 p.m. but yeah, the hours, we're open almost 12 hours every single day, aside from Sunday.
Now, that's very rare for a record shop to have those hours these days. Yeah?
Definitely, yeah. Most places, you know, an eight-hour day is long. But the owner, he's been in promotion for the music industry, and he understands, you know, we have venues nearby, and a lot of the kids want to come dig. It's one of those industries where, you know, people have day jobs, and especially on the weekends, like, they want to go get some food, cruise over to the record store, especially with our complex being mainly food, a lot of restaurants. You know, people grab dinner around 7 or 8, and then they want to come here for a couple hours and dig. So if we had closed up at 8, we'd miss that kind of business, and we definitely don't want to miss that.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
we stay open late.
And why it's great for someone like me who's, I'm taking the kids to Disneyland, they're now asleep in the hotel, and now I can come and kind of do a little bit of shopping here.
We get a lot of people like that, which is nice. So.
Cool. Excellent. Anything else you'd like to share about the shop or how people can find your shop?
We do the social media thing. We're on Instagram, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook. So we really try and utilize that. We do like a guerrilla style for our promotion. Cause we, you know, word of mouth is always the best way to go, in my opinion. So it's just been a nice progression, getting the word out, and you know, find us on eBay. If you're in town, come and stop by, say hi. We're open late, obviously. Yeah, and come dig, because we really have everything when it comes to genres. So you name it, we probably have
something for everyone.
Exactly.
Excellent. And any advice you would give people who are just starting to build their record collection?
You know, I always feel a little like iffy when I hear, you know, a new album is coming out. am not sure about like fully committing to it. Mm-hmm. So find the things that you know you love and start with that. You'd be surprised how much has been reissued. So do a little research. Discogs is a great website to just kind of see what actually exists out there. And start there. Just kind of find the few things that you know you love and then start to branch out. Do a little more research. Get comfortable with, you know, being in a record store, cause especially when, like, a lot of people walk in here and it's a little overwhelming just because we have so much. And build a list. Like, put a list together because the moment you walk in the door, it disappears.
Your brain goes crazy, right?
Yeah. Like, everything disappears. So have a list. That always helps. And then save your money. Get a good turntable, something that's going to last and sound good. That's my best advice.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Kimberly. Really appreciate it. And I look forward to turning the off switch on here and seeing what you got in stock.
Cool. Sounds good. Thanks for coming by.
No worries. Thank you. Cheers.
All right, well, that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Want to thank the crew over at Porto Sound Records. I left there with a really cool Howlin' Wolf album. I'll post pictures of that online. Very happy to have been able to find that Howlin' Wolf on Crown Records. Also, good luck to everyone who is now going to be searching for that John Lennon Roots LP. It's a real cheap piece of crap, but it's got a story behind it. So, you know, if you run across it, it's one you want to keep. And that's it for me. Make sure to go to www.thevinylguide.com. Subscribe if you haven't already. So that way you never miss an episode. And those of you who are regular listeners, please leave us a positive review on iTunes. That always helps us so, so, so much. All right, well, that's it for this week. Until we talk next week, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.